WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hank Williams is one of the originators of country music. My guest, Colin Escott, is the author of a new biography of Williams. Escott says Williams made the single most important body of recordings in country music. He set the standard by which success is measured on every level, including self-destruction. Williams died at the age of 29. In his short 6-year recording career, he made such now classic recordings as Your Cheatin' Heart, I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, Lovesick Blues, Honky Tonkin', Cold Cold Heart, I Can't Help It If I'm Still in Love with You, and Jambalaya. There's a 3-CD box set of his recordings produced by Escott. Colin Escott last joined us on Fresh Air to talk about his book, Good Rockin' Tonight, A History of Sun Records. Let's start with Your Cheatin' Heart, which was released in January of 1953, just a few weeks after Hank Williams' death.
Your cheatin' heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep. But sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you. When tears come down like falling rain, you'll toss around and call my name. I do. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
Colin Escott, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to place Hank Williams for us within country music.
Well, you know, before Hank, country music kind of existed in sort of discrete regional as discrete regional units. You know, you had Western swing on the West Coast, and in Texas and Oklahoma, you had cowboy music, you had East Coast Philadelphia country music, and you had hillbilly music. And I think what Hank did more than anything was to unify country music to the point where it became an identifiable commodity for the first time. You know, after Hank, there was just country music, and that was it.
Tell us a little bit about the family he grew up in and the home he grew up in.
Well, it seems like everyone figures they come from a dysfunctional family these days, but I don't know what Hank really did. You know, his father left home when he was about 6 and went into a Veterans Administration hospital in Louisiana, and Hank didn't see him but maybe once or twice for the next 10 or 12 years. And his mother was a fearsomely independent woman. She started up boarding house businesses, first in little towns like Greenville and Georgiana, and then in Montgomery. And Hank grew up there, but, you know, because his mom was running these boarding houses, she really didn't have a lot of time for little Hank. And, you know, Hank really grew up by himself, and you can sense a lot of that in the way he sings, you know, that kind of lonesomeness that everyone points out at the core of Hank Williams.
I want to play the very first record that he recorded. This was made in 1942, 6 years before he actually recorded commercially. The recording is I'm Not Coming Home Anymore. Tell us a little bit about the song and the circumstances under which he recorded this.
Well, it was cut at a radio store in Montgomery, and Hank was live every day on WSFA then, which was just about the only radio station of any size in Montgomery. And he had a little 15-minute show. And he was a big noise around Montgomery, and a guy that ran the radio shop there recorded him off the air. And that's really what you're hearing. It's just Hank. And if you listen closely, you can hear an electric guitar and a bass. But really, it's just Hank and his guitar. But the amazing thing is that 6 years before, you know, before Hank became famous, his style was really pretty much in place.
Let's listen.
Oh, there ain't no use to cry. goodbye. We have discussed that o'er and o'er. So you go your way. You may laugh me high, for I'm not coming home anymore.
In 1946, Hank Williams went to Nashville. Now Nashville's the Tin Pan Alley of country music. What was it like in the mid-40s when he went there?
Well, that's one of the things I really wanted to try and bring out in the book, that Nashville hadn't always been Nashville. You know, today you think of country music, you think of Nashville, like you think of Mutual and Omaha. But back then you had all kinds of regional centers for country music. You had the West Coast, Los Angeles, you had Chicago, you had Cincinnati, you had Philadelphia. And you had Memphis, you had Dallas, and Nashville was just one of many, and it hadn't yet established its preeminence. So when Hank went to Nashville, he wasn't going to the hub of country music as he would be today.
So what was he going to? How many music publishers were there? Were a lot of people recording there?
There were maybe a couple of music publishers in town, certainly no more than that, and there was one little bitty recording studio that was operated as a kind of moonlighting operation by some engineers at the Grand Ole Opry station, WSM. And really, beyond that, there wasn't much. Such industry as there was kind of centered around the Opry. And in a way, it's a measure of Hank's achievement that the country music industry focused itself upon Nashville in the years ahead. It was partly due to the preeminence of the Opry, but the Opry's preeminence was partly or perhaps even mostly due to Hank.
So when he got to Nashville, he signed a writer's contract. What did that mean for him?
Well, it was the first step on the ladder. You know, everyone's got to take that first step, and this was Hank's. He had been invited to Nashville because Columbia Records had just signed a very traditional act called Molly O'Day and her Cumberland Mountain Folks, and Fred Rose, the music publisher, who was the one big music publisher in Nashville, had been assigned to find songs for Molly O'Day. And no one in his little operation was churning out anything that he thought Molly could use. And Molly told him about this guy down in Montgomery who was churning out just the kind of songs that she needed. And in that way, Hank came to Nashville.
I want to play one of Hank Williams' first commercially released recordings. And this is Move It On Over. Do you think that, in a way, this is one of his most important up-tempo recordings?
Well, it is, because what you hear there is the clear debt to black music. You know, there really hadn't been a whole lot of black music influence in hillbilly music up to that point. And in Move It On Over, you can hear the debt that Hank owed to the black rural string bands that he'd grown up listening to, you know, down in southern Alabama.
This is Move It On Over, Hank Williams.
Came in last night at 10:30. That baby of mine wouldn't let me in, so move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, little dog, 'cause the big dog's moving in. She's changed the lock on our front door. My door key don't fit no more, so get it on over.
Move it on over.
Scoot it on over.
Move it on over.
Move over, skinny dog, 'cause the fat dog's moving in.
My guest is Colin Escott. He's written a new biography of Hank Williams. He also produced a 3-CD set of Hank Williams recordings. Now, you say that this recording, Moving On Over, shows the influence of black music on Hank Williams. He actually learned to play guitar from a black street musician.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I wish to God I could have been there so that I'd know exactly what it was that Hank got off this guy. I mean, his name was T-Tot, or his nickname was T-Tot, because he drank out of a flask that had a mixture of tea and alcohol in it. And Hank used to follow him around almost obsessively. And he'd pay T-Tot, you know, whatever little money he could scrounge up to teach him what? I don't know, teach him chords maybe, certainly teach him in broader strokes, like the importance of getting a good rhythm going and how to project to an audience and things like that.
You know, I think a lot of us, because the South was segregated, a lot of us are surprised when we hear about a white musician who learned from a black musician or by a white musician who was so influenced by black music.
Yeah, I mean, everyone tends to think that that all started with Elvis Presley, but of course it didn't. And even before Hank, you had yodeling Jimmy Rogers down in Meridian, Mississippi, who grew up listening to the blues musicians down there. And when he started singing, it was a kind of curious mixture of you know, 1920s blues and sentimental Victorian pop songs. And you know, Rogers is called the father of country music, and you know, half of what he sang really was blues. But it was rarer, much rarer, in hillbilly music, which really was rooted in Anglo-Celtic forms. And Hank was the first person to introduce elements of black music into hillbilly music.
My guest is Colin Escott. He's written a new biography of Hank Williams. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Colin Escott about his new biography of Hank Williams. Hank Williams recording Lovesick Blues is one of his most famous recordings. It was a turning point in his career, and it turns out it was a show tune. It was from a musical review. Tell us about the origins of this song.
Boy, how long have you got? I mean, this is a song that dated back to 1922, which made it a year older than Hank. And it was for a failed Broadway show called Ooh, Ernest, which is about lovesick airmen during the First World War. And it kicked around in one form or another. And by the time Hank got it, it had mutated a few times and lost a few chords. And one of the verses had become the chorus. And really, I mean, Hank's music publisher said it was a mess, and it was a mess. But Hank had been working on this thing and working on it and working on it. And even though what emerged was a mess, it was so compelling. I mean, it was a compelling mess, and I mean, it was almost a numbingly inconsequential song. It wasn't really a blues. It certainly wasn't a country song, but it just had that little magic thing that just made radio audiences sit up and take notice.
Well, this is Hank Williams' recording of Lovesick Blues.
I got a feeling of the blues, oh Lord, since my baby said goodbye. Lord, I don't know what I'll do. All I do is sit and sigh. Oh Lord, that last long day she said goodbye. Well Lord, I thought I would cry. She'll do me, she'll do you. She's got that kind of loving. Lord, I love to hear her when she called me sweet daddy. Such a beautiful dream. I hate to think it all over. I've lost my heart, it seems. I've grown so used to you somehow. Well, I'm nobody's sugar daddy now. And I'm lonesome. I got the lovesick blues.
This recording, you call this the spark that ignited his career. Even though he didn't write the song, how did it change his career?
Well, Hank was in Louisiana. He was playing the Louisiana Hayride, which was one of the Opry's rivals. It was a rival Saturday Night Jubilee. And he wasn't writing. He'd stopped writing songs for some reason. And he'd resuscitated this old song from songs that he'd learned growing up, and he started playing it on shows, and people seemed to like it on shows, and then he started playing it on the hayride, and people liked it on the hayride, and then he recorded it, and from playing it on the hayride, he had this sort of backlog of people who wanted to buy it lined up halfway across the country, and it just exploded. It was just one of those things like the Banana Boat song a few years later. It just became one of those huge, uncontainable monster hit records that no one could explain, and it was the catalyst that got him out of the minor leagues and got him into the majors.
After the success of Lovesick Blues, Hank Williams became a regular cast member of the Opry.
Well, yeah, you know, the Opry now seems like the only game in town when it comes to Saturday night radio jamborees, but it certainly wasn't then. There were hundreds of them. And the Opry was running scared of two or three of them, particularly the Louisiana Hayride that Hank was on. And they recruited him from the Hayride, afraid that he was going to act as a kind of spearhead attraction for the Hayride and help it to overtake the Opry. So they hired him away, and then he was pleased to come.
So he helped make the Opry more successful when he came over.
Absolutely.
I want to move on to I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry. This was actually the B-side of My Bucket's Got a Hole in It. What were they thinking when they released that as the B-side?
Well, one thing you got to appreciate is that a lot of Hank's records, all of Hank's records, were aimed at jukeboxes. They weren't aimed at buyers, record buyers the way they are today. The primary customer for records back then was jukebox operators. And when people went to punch up a record on a jukebox, they didn't want to hear a slow, mournful song. They wanted something with a bit of zip in it. And, My Bucket's Got a Hole in It was just the ticket. And I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, for all its poeticism and everything, just didn't play as well on jukeboxes.
So how did I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry become the real... I assume that was the side that finally sold.
No, it wasn't. My Bucket's Got a Hole in It. Was the side that sold. That was the one that got up to number one and number two on the charts. I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry was just kind of languished as a B-side, and it wasn't until after Hank died and people started looking back started investigating his catalog in a little more detail that they found songs like I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry and You Win Again, which was another B-side.
Well, let's hear I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry.
Lonesome whippoorwill, he sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry. I've never seen a night so long. When time goes crawling by, the moon just went behind the clouds to hide its face and cry.
Colin Escott is my guest. He's written a new biography of Hank Williams. You say by 1951, Williams' career was controlling him. What were the problems he was having?
Well, most people wouldn't regard them as problems. He was getting invitations from television networks to go on nationwide television. He was getting approaches from MGM's. He recorded for MGM Records, and he was getting approaches from the movie division to make movies. He was being asked to headline country music shows in Boston, in Las Vegas, and just all over. Yeah, but Hank. Hank had a much keener sense of his limitations than anyone else did. And he was a guy who really didn't have a whole lot of education, and who 3 or 4 years earlier had been playing little schoolhouse dates and honky-tonks and beer joints down in Louisiana and Alabama and East Texas for peanuts, really. And he found it very, very hard to cope with this new audience and the incredible career pressures of having to be at a certain place at a certain time. But when he started out, he'd play a beer joint, and if he showed, he showed. If he didn't, he'd do a make good if he felt like it. And if he didn't feel like it, he'd just blow it off. It all began to weigh heavily upon him.
Williams was a heavy drinker as far back as when he was a teenager. By the early 50s, how was alcohol affecting his reputation as a performer and a person?
Well, Hank's first response to stress was always to go reach for the bottle, and he did that more and more, partly because of the career pressures and partly because he suffered from a spinal condition called spina bifida, which must have been incredibly painful for him, riding those hundreds of thousands of miles in the car. And he drank basically to escape the career pressures and escape the pain that he had almost constantly from about 1950-51 onwards in his back. And he, you know, the alcohol began to make him very unreliable. By the end of 51, you know, he was, you know, the drinking was really starting to get out of control.
He was taking pain medication then too.
That's right. Yeah, he was mixing it with heavy duty barbiturates, and you know, this was starting to affect his show rate. You know, the reliability of him turning up was sinking from maybe 85-90% to maybe 500, maybe 50%.
He was only 29 when he died. What killed him?
It was a combination of everything he was doing. It was a combination of morphine, which he was taking for his back, chloral hydrate, which he was taking for his back pain, and alcohol, together with a generally dissipated physical condition that came from, you know, the lifestyle he had led for the last 5 or 6 years, really. You know, everything weighed upon him, and by the time he died, he was really a man without another option. You know, he was physically wrecked. The back pain was irremediable. The alcoholism was something that he couldn't escape from, no matter how hard he tried. And his death, which has, you know, so often been described as a dreadful accident, was just an accident that was waiting to happen.
Colin Escott, do you think that Hank Williams influenced country music not only in terms of his music, but also in terms of himself as the tragic figure? I mean, you know, that sense of the tragic figure has become so important in the mythology of country music.
Yeah, everyone, you know, when someone drives their truck into Nashville hoping to make it in the business, you know, they've always got Hank Williams in the back of their mind and always thinking that they're going to avoid his terrible fate. But, you know, that live hard, love fast, die young thing is just rooted in, you know, it's just part of country music mythology.
Colin Escott, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Colin Escott is the author of a new biography of Hank Williams. He also produced a CD box set of Williams' recordings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.